Hello and welcome to Saver, production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about couscous.
Yes, which is inspired, this whole topic idea, by a recent fight between me and my friends about what was the better side at a Mediterranean restaurant, Aviva, which I posted pictures of. They're excellent shawarma memes.
Oh, yeah. They're so good.
Yes.
They have gotten me through many a Dragon Con.
Yes. And that's where we were there during Dragon Con, and we talked about it in some episode about how they're kind of well-known as—
Maybe the shawarma episode?
Yes. That makes total sense. It makes total sense. So there were two sides, the lentils and the couscous, and— We all took sides on which was the better one, and we even went back again so a friend who didn't get to try them the first time could try both of them and weigh in.
Because you needed the full panel.
Yes.
Okay.
And lentils won, even though one person hilariously didn't try the lentils, but she still voted for lentils.
Huh.
She said,
just
I love lentils.
Principle. Yeah.
Yeah, and if I had been on the couscous side, I would have really not liked that. The guy was on the lentil side, so I was all about it. But we aren't talking about lentils today. We're talking about couscous. And no offense to couscous. I love couscous, and it is a very different thing than lentils. Just at this particular instance, this particular battle of sides.
This one side dish versus this other side dish.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought lentils was the clear winner. But I do love couscous, and I went through a huge couscous phase in college because it was one of my mom's faves, but my dad didn't like it, mm-hmm. so we hardly ever ate it. And once I had access, I went all in, perhaps too much all in. I should have backed off, maybe.
I was doing a lot of couscous-based, like, stew dishes for a while, oof. Like college and post-college. Yeah, I was like, this is a terrific grain. For some reason, I feel like it's healthier.
Yeah.
than pasta, which it's not particularly, but.
Yes, more on that in a bit.
Absolutely, but first, this brings us to our question.
Couscous. What is it?
Well, couscous is a type of usually wheat flour grain product. It's sort of like a small round pasta. The tiny balls or grains of couscous are rolled up from a type of coarse ground wheat flour called semolina, which is made just sticky enough to ball up with water plus a little bit of salt, and then run through sieves to kind of standardize the side. You know, the smaller particles fall through, and then you can kind of roll them back up into bigger ones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the balls are typically steamed until cooked. The result is a light, fluffy, chewy, just slightly tacky mass of these little amber yellow balls, which have a nutty and weedy flavor. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. And may then be served in any number of ways.
Yes. Couscous can be a side or a main, or it can be a component in soups or salads. There's a variety of options available. A decent amount of grocery stores have them here in the States. And of varying quality. I saw a lot of articles debating that. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
There are fancy versions and cheap versions.
Around the world, it's often eaten like a cereal or a porridge, either sweet or salty, with a fresh or fermented milk, which sounds so good. I really want to try that.
Yeah.
Or as the grain base for savory stews or desserts. There's also a couscous made from fermented wheat.
Oh.
I know. Oh, so many things.
Yes.
Anyway, in some areas, a dish of couscous made with seven vegetables in particular is part of local New Year celebrations. Couscous is also a traditional meal after Friday midday prayers at some mosques.
Oh, okay.
Those areas and localities. So couscous hails from and is a staple throughout northern Africa, particularly the Maghreb region. Today, that encompasses the countries of that northern coast of Africa west of Egypt, specifically Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, and Mauritania. That New Year's dish I was talking about is specifically from the Amazigh people, which are the native peoples of northern Africa and the north parts of western Africa. Amazigh is a preferred term for who Europeans previously called the Berber people. The plural, by the way, is Amazighan, which it'll just come up later. Anyway. But yes, among Amazighan and Arabic peoples, and everyone in the region, really, there are a lot of cultural and subcultural and seasonal and event-based and individual ways of preparing couscous. It's mm-hmm. it's up there with pasta or rice as like a foundational, hospitable, iconic, shared cultural dish that's part of a group identity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So much so that in Algeria, one local word for couscous just means food or nourishment.
Mm-hmm.
One particularly worldwide spread spice blend for couscous, though, is ras lehanout, which usually consists of cumin, nutmeg, cinnamon, coriander, pepper, clove, turmeric, and ginger. Kind of mix in there. that sort of thing.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I remember that's a lot of what I was making stews with when I was using a lot of couscous. That was a lot of, like, Moroccan spice blend.
Oh, sure.
Recipes that I found.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing I didn't know is you can buy super fancy couscous-making pots.
They can be so fancy.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so these traditionally have a bottom pot for water or broth that creates the steam, in with which you might also cook meat and or veg for the stew that you want to serve over your couscous.
Uh-huh.
And then there's an interlocking top pot that's a steam basket for the couscous grains themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, these pots can be these, like, lovely painted ceramics or, like, really industrial aluminum or fancy hammered copper.
I just want to look at some. I don't need one because I don't make enough couscous. But I want to just enjoy, admire.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Yeah, it's weird. Like, especially in the States, couscous is so often bought pre-made and dried as a sort of, like, instant or low-fuss product, similar to dried pastas, but even lower fuss than that, I think. But yeah, it can certainly be made by hand. And according to fans of the product, you absolutely should. There's an article in Food & Wine that described it as the difference between, like, buying shelf-stable bread and baking your own bread at home.
Yeah.
Which is a dramatic difference.
Very much.
Mm-hmm. You can also do so in batches and dry some for cooking later.
True.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Those pots, I love the words involved in this episode. Those pots are called couscousiers in French.
That's great. That's so good.
Speaking of words, the etymology of couscous is a little bit twisty.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple related words from different languages in the region. There's the Arabic kaskasa, which is the verb for to pound small. And there's an MSI language word, seksu, which means, like, well-rolled or formed. And either of those words might have led to the onomatopoeia keskes for the sound that the balls of couscous make when they're being sieved.
Uh-huh.
Which might have led to the name for the product being couscous, and also for the steam pot that they're cooked in, which is kaskas in Arabic.
Lots of options.
There are so many options.
History, mystery, etymology edition.
Yes.
The Hebrew word for Israeli couscous translates to little crumbles.
Oh.
Also, apropos, accurate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I wanted to say a quick word about semolina flour. It's made from the starchy insides of grains of a particular species of wheat called durum wheat. It's the same stuff that's used to make pasta. And it can either be ground more or less coarsely, but often appears more like a fine cornmeal than what Americans would typically consider the texture of a wheat flour to be. It's only about 5 to 8% of the world's wheat grown.
Huh.
Yeah, relatively small amount.
Yeah.
Couscous can be made with other grains, though. Sometimes corn is used in Brazil. A millet or a barley or cassava may be used in different parts of Africa.
What about the nutrition?
Well, couscous by itself is mostly carbs. There's a little bit of protein in there from the grain, and some fat is usually used in the making of it. It's got a lot of selenium. It's a great base for other foods because it will help fill you up, but it won't particularly keep you going.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and that golden color of couscous comes from our old friend carotenoids, which also make carrots and cultured butter yellow.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you know? We do have some numbers.
Absolutely. So, okay, couscous and pasta markets are usually reported together. The pasta part does dominate, but globally, couscous is expected to be a $6 billion a year market by 2026.
Look at you, couscous.
I know. Yeah, both sides are growing. You know, they're easy to throw into the base of an inexpensive meal, and folks these days appreciate that.
Yes, true. Couscous is huge in France. It's on so many Parisian menus. More on why in the history segment.
A survey in a French magazine in 2011 indicated that it is the third favorite dish in France as a whole and the first favorite in Eastern France.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., couscous has become more popular as fascination with the Mediterranean diet has grown, along with vegetarianism and, in general, a desire for more healthy food, or food that we perceive as more healthy anyway. We're very susceptible to marketing, we humans.
Yep.
Marketing. Yes.
Marking and marketing. Either
yes.
way.
Yes. Marking as a target for marketing.
Oh, yes. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In some regions, couscous has a symbolic and religious meaning. Muslim women prepare couscous as part of a celebratory family get-togethers for births, for wedding feasts, and it's often eaten at the end of Ramadan. Because of this, couscous is associated with fidelity, solidarity, fertility, abundance, and God's blessing. Women who make couscous are expected to make an invocation and talk about positive things like prosperity and make religious conversation. In some areas.
Sure, yeah. And we do have some history for you here, as you might suspect. But first, as you might suspect, we have a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And yes, we're back with another controversial history segment.
Ah, yes.
Yes. Buckle up, everybody. A lot of regions like to claim ownership over couscous, particularly in North Africa. A lot of countries do. However, some historians suggest that the ancient Romans may have invented it back when they controlled the area and planted wheat there.
I don't think that's it.
No. The Amazighen were making it by 238 to 149 BCE, or that's according to one historian.
Based on descriptions of pots that resemble today's couscous vessels found in tombs from the region during that era.
Another historian claims couscous wasn't really a thing until sometime between the 11th and 13th centuries.
Yeah, the 13th or 14th century was when it started popping up in Arabic cookbooks, which was a few hundred years after Arabic peoples began invading and populating the region. Etymology suggests that the indigenous Amazighen were making it before the Arabs got there.
Whatever the case, it was a very popular dish in this region and quickly spread to neighboring areas, the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa. The 13th century is when the Amazighen introduced the Iberian Peninsula to couscous, where it was quickly adopted and disseminated. This influence spread to Sephardic Jews who made it their own and took it with them to countries that they fled to for asylum after they were largely forced out of the Iberian Peninsula, hence the modern-day popularity of couscous in Israel. Mm-hmm. Two cookbooks from this time period featured couscous recipes. An anonymous North African cookbook from the 13th century written by Aleppo also had a recipe for something resembling couscous. A Syrian historian active at the time made four references to couscous in his works. Couscous was a popular choice among the Moriscos as well, former Muslims in Spain who had been baptized and accepted into Christianity, usually who had been coerced into doing so, mm-hmm. often with death threats, mm-hmm. after practicing Islam was banned in that country at the beginning of the 16th century. Many were expelled, and couscous got tied up in all of this mess. Eating couscous could earn you a prosecution from the Inquisition.
Wow.
Yep. Couscous made its way to Turkey by the 16th century. Around this time, Portuguese royalty and nobility kept eating African-influenced couscous. The 17th century Spanish court cookbook with a couscous recipe probably had to do with the author's Portuguese heritage. When it comes to Italy's couscousou, a popular Sicilian dish typically served alongside fish stew or maybe even alongside a dessert, historians think it could go back to 827 to 1063 CE, the Muslim period, or when the Sephardic Jews settled there towards the end of the 15th century. By the 16th century, couscous made it to Brazil, introduced in part by the influence of the Portuguese and in part by arriving enslaved people from West Africa. And from what I read, there are two types of couscous in Brazil. Northern, frequently eaten for breakfast, a steamed pudding of sugar, tapioca flour, and coconut milk. Or southern, steamed cake-shaped corn flour with spices, vegetables, and chicken or fish. Frenchman François Rabelais wrote about couscous in his 1542 novel Gargantua. Yes.
And by the mid-1800s, large-scale couscous mills were operating in places like Ferrero, Algiers, and industrializing production. Meanwhile, France was doing a bunch of colonizing in North Africa in the 18 and early 1900s, and they were sticking around, would not be totally overthrown until the 1960s.
Yes, and this kind of brings us to what we were talking about in the beginning of why couscous, such a thing in France.
Yes.
Okay. In the 1950s, expats from French-influenced Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, also known as the Maghreb, started settling in France, going on to become the largest immigrant group in that country. And of course, they brought their cuisines with them. And of course, some of them opened restaurants. Some of those restaurants were upscale. For instance, you could have the Grand Dame of Moroccan cuisine in Paris, Fatima Hall, a chef and cookbook author who opened a restaurant called Mansouria in 1984. And from what I understand, people just know about this place.
Yes.
It was a white tablecloth Moroccan restaurant that attracted a lot of celebrities and politicians. For her recipes, she went to Morocco, devoting years to interviewing women and a cast of female cooks that is quickly vanishing. She imbued her restaurants with her feminism, hiring only women. She believed that, quote, a dish exists to heal each one of our woes. Regardless of religious or political disputes, people can communicate when they share a meal. And this was something that she lived by. She spoke at a 2001 conference in Israel called The Cuisine of Connections and spearheaded the interfaith Couscous for Peace. Mm-hmm. Quote, what is important is to hear the stories that the dish, the produce, the techniques have to tell us. I like to think of myself as an ear that can hear when cuisine whispers. She has so many good quotes. I was like, oh, Annie, you cannot make this whole episode quotes from her.
Oh, maybe future episode. We could do a profile on her.
Oh, yes, I would be so in.
Heck yeah.
Simultaneously, we see the birth of Israeli couscous. When the Jews fled Eastern Europe for Israel in droves in the 1950s, the then Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion was desperately searching for a cheap, easy to mass produce grain alternative to rice. Voila, the vaguely rice-shaped noodles called petitim, here in the States called Israeli couscous. Mm-hmm. People sometimes called them Ben-Gurion's rice. When rice was once again readily available, Israeli couscous became more pearl-like in shape. And I think that's what I'm more familiar with in my personal experience.
Yes, I think that that's the only type that I've seen. It's apparently mostly a children's food there, and like folks produce therefore fun shapes like hearts and stars.
Oh, cool. So cute.
Y'all write in. But yeah, the general internet consensus is that it is not a like fancy food over mm-hmm. there, the way that it has been adopted as sure. over here. It's more like a inexpensive staple and like a semi-nostalgic reminder of lean times and comfort food in the past.
Okay. Hmm. And then another story goes that Israeli couscous didn't make it in the U.S. until the 1990s. Mika Sharon, an Israeli chef and cookbook author living in New York, had Don Pintabona, an American chef and cookbook author, over for dinner. Sharon served Israeli couscous at the dinner, and Pintabona started serving it in his New York-based restaurant and then spread from there.
And the rest is fancy restaurant history.
True.
No, none of those harder star shapes, though.
No, bummer.
Yeah. In 2007, a Franco-Tunisian film came out called, in translation, The Secret of the Grain, referring to couscous. It's a story about a Tunisian immigrant family living in France.
Oh.
Yeah. As of 2013, in an experiment that simulated a mission to Mars with six volunteers testing all sorts of technologies and, like, living situations for 4 months in this special station that was built out in Hawaii, it was reported that the volunteers loved their couscous option. They brought 25 pounds and apparently went through it in a flash.
All right, couscous.
Right?
Hey.
In 2016, couscous had a viral moment, a particularly viral internet moment. Science communicator Steve Mould used a stringed bow drawn across the edge of a large metal plate to demonstrate how different parts of a solid object will vibrate or not when sound waves interact with that solid object. And basically what's happening here is that like a flat surface is vibrated at resonance. Different parts of it vibrate in opposite directions, with the borders between those regions, where I think the waves cancel out, being these lines of zero vibration in between these vibrating areas. So a spill of couscous across the surface of the plate aligned itself into those calm areas, which form a type of geometric figure called a Chladni figure, after the early 19th century scientist who we think is the first person to have noticed this.
Huh.
So if you've ever seen, like, sand or couscous on a big old, like, yeah. square plate of glass or metal.
Yeah.
That's what's going on.
You know? Couscous, got to get involved in science. I love it.
And then this year, on March 29th of 2019, couscous was submitted for consideration for addition to the UNESCO List of Intangible Cultural Heritage of Humanity. Specifically, quote, knowledge, know-how, and practices related to the production and consumption of couscous.
Hey. Mm-hmm.
Ambassadors got together from Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia, and Mauritania, and put it forward jointly for the 2020 cycle of decision-making. So we'll hear about that.
We'll keep you posted.
We will.
Sit on the edge of our seats.
Gosh, I hope it gets in there.
I hope so, too.
I'd be mad if it didn't.
I don't see why not. But, you know, we've seen our, here in the U.S., our snack debates.
Yeah. I was looking through UNESCO's archives, and there's already one entry in there on these lists for a pilgrimage through a certain area. And part of the cultural rites of the pilgrimage are the making of couscous. So I can't imagine that it wouldn't be in there, that it wouldn't be decided to be put in there.
Well, you know what side we're on. Anyone that is involved in the making of this decision is listening.
For once, Annie is on Team Couscous.
I am on Team Couscous. And when we do lentils, I'll be on Team Lentils. But I can be on both sides.
You can.
I can bridge this.
You can.
That's what couscous all about.
Yes. And lentils.
Yeah. Food in general.
And food in general.
Food in general.
I guess that's sort of why we make this show.
Yeah. Look where we've come. I'm getting all... My heart's doing a thing. Hopefully a good thing.
Fingers crossed. Oh, yeah. Well, while we figure that out,
right.
We're going to take one more quick break for a word from our sponsor, and then we will be back with a little bit of listener mail.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with
listener mail.
I don't know how to make the couscous. That would have been hard to do, though. Probably just freaked someone out. I'm sorry.
Oh, probably. Yeah.
I apologize. That was... And it can't be edited.
Yeah, this is all live, people.
Oh, gosh.
No, it's not.
Okay. Allison wrote, I spent a number of years of my adult life thinking I was immune to onions making me cry.
Uh-huh.
I've never had more than a slight irritation when chopping onions. Then one day, my eyes started burning horribly and watering. I couldn't figure out why until I realized that I was wearing glasses instead of contacts that day. Since then, there have been a number of times when I'd inadvertently started chopping onions while wearing glasses with painful results. This should be unlikely since I tend to wear contacts at least 6 days a week.
Uh-huh.
But I have now learned to plan ahead on days when I'm using onions in a dinner recipe to wear contacts that day. Just a tip for anyone who might wear contacts. And she's not the only person who wrote in about this.
Oh, that's great.
Several people did. Huh. So I guess
it's a thing.
It's some kind of barrier. I don't know.
Sure, yeah.
Like soaks up onion. You know, when in Magic School Bus, when it shows like those little yellow squigglies and it's supposed to represent something in the air. Is that just me? I'm not making that up, right?
I'm sure you're not. I don't specifically remember what the heck you're talking about.
Okay.
But I believe you. And also, I guess it would make sense that, that you know, it's something about the way that the contact interacts with the, like, liquid coating of your, that stays on your eyeball, your, like, tear film.
Right.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Oh, now I want to go look up more stuff about tear films. They're really gross and terrific. The surface of your eyeball is real weird, y'all.
It is. I'm torn if I want to know more or not.
Oh, you got a little bit sad there. Yeah, yeah. Also, while I was doing recent research, I learned that that specific types of Vidalia-related onions, like Maui onions in particular, have way less sulfur than most other types of onions. So they're a little bit sweeter and less, like, piquant.
Mm-hmm.
And that might lower the, like, factor.
Yeah. I feel like it does. Every time I cut open an onion, I forget about the thing, and then it's too late. I'm always so mad about it. Like, oh. Damn it. Damn it, onion.
It's the one benefit of not being able to eat onions.
I mean, I'm kind of impressed by it, though. It's one of those things where I'm annoyed, and then I have that moment of, like, yeah. Good for you, onion.
Good on you, onion.
Yeah, you got me good.
Claire wrote, the biggest food waste culprit in my two-person household has always been letting fresh ingredients or leftovers go bad before getting around to cooking or eating them. The problem was that I would be feeling highly aspirational while at the grocery store, plan to make some big fancy meal, and come home with a bunch of fresh ingredients, only to not be feeling it when dinner time came around and resort to easier fare. Gosh, I feel you. Cue the sad violin for the sad bunch of carrots languishing in the bottom drawer of the fridge. The other problem came when I did make a big batch of something and then couldn't manage to eat it all before it went bad. I know, these are the very definition of first world problems. But in the last year or so, I've started using the heck out of my freezer in a new way, and it's made a huge difference. Using a muffin tin and a set of silicone muffin liners, I freeze most things we make shortly after cooking them. Once frozen through, I pop the muffin-sized cubes out of the liners and store them in large freezer bags. Side note, I reuse the freezer bags as much as possible, but I'm still working on a greener option that doesn't rely on plastic packaging. This way, the cooking inspiration doesn't have to coincide with dinner time. There are no worries about leftovers going bad. Plus, the little cubes make it really easy to heat up one or two servings at a time. The only downside is that we're starting to run out of freezer space, and I live in terror of the day that the power goes out and everything melts. Here are some of the things I've had success freezing this way. Soups. So many soups. We have 5 different soups to choose from at any given time. Curries. Cooked beans, refried beans, and lentils. Ratatouille. Cooked rice, quinoa, and other grains. Mashed potatoes. Whipping cream and milk for future use in recipes, frozen in the pre-measured quarter cup portions. We don't drink milk on the day-to-day, but it's great to have on hand for baking, etc. Bread dough and pizza dough. Anyway, I know preserving by freezing is no new revelation, but using the muffin tin method has been a real game changer for us. Hope it helps someone else tackle their food waste problem as well.
I love it.
I've
done something similar to this, and it does really help having like the I know how much this is
mm-hmm.
kind of portion sizes. But I'm inspired. I'm inspired to try more.
Yeah. One of my favorite things is if I'm baking and a recipe calls for only an egg white or only an egg yolk, then I'll freeze the extra bits in the freezer in little Tupperwares and as opposed to freezing them in the microwave and just label them with how much it is. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a single lady. So the problem I have a lot is a lot of stuff doesn't come in single portions.
Human sizes, no.
Yeah. So the thing about milk is a great one because I can never have milk. I will never drink it before it goes bad. But now I could just freeze it.
Yeah.
Yes. So thank you. Thanks to both of you for writing in. If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, all at SaverPod. We do hope to hear from you. Savor is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can go to the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.